Take 21,000 volunteers, 1,000 free bicycles, and one college math class, and what does it add up to? An efficient Democratic National Convention. Surprisingly so. Youth radio reporter Pendarvis Harshaw sent us this story from Denver.
Standing on the corner of 14th and Stout Street in downtown Denver, there's definitely a chaotic feel. There are tons of people, Secret Service agents, groups of delegates, and this guy.
Can I help you find anything or get anywhere?
It may seem random that Democratic Convention volunteer Brad Lorvik found himself assigned to this corner, but according to Matt Nabity, there's a strategy behind the placement of every single one of the roughly 21,000 volunteers. And he says at the root of it all, there's a mathematical formula.
How do you take people and their availability and assign them tasks and assign them times without abusing them? The list goes on and on, so it's a huge information problem, and there's so much data to go through.
Nabity is pursuing a PhD in applied math at the University of Colorado, where he took a course this past spring, examining three practical problems that the convention would bring to Denver. One, how to organize thousands of volunteers. Two, how to design a bike sharing system. And three, how to assign space for various competing events. And to Nabity and his classmates, these problems aren't just quantitative.
I mean, math is more than just computations. It's not just, you know, add, subtract, this line, that line.
He's not joking. The variables in their equations, which you need a math degree to follow, include a range of data collected from prospective volunteers. Brad Lorvik, that energetic volunteer stationed at 14th Street and Stout, was surprised to be asked,
what area of town would you like to work in? What days are you available to work? What skills do you have? Even when it came down to the computer skills, they asked me if I was an Apple person or a PC person.
The math students weren't really expected to predict how many Apple computer lovers might apply, but they were asked to estimate problems like how many total volunteers the convention would need, where the most volunteers would be needed, and when the busiest times might be. This issue of supply and demand came up over and over for the class, but oftentimes they were working with abstract models. Take the bike share problem. Today there are 1,000 shiny donated bikes with locks, helmets, lights, and computers, but no one knew that number until recently, says Matt Nabity.
We had to guess. We had to speculate. You know, what would you do based on what we think the demand is going to be? But once you have a model set up, those are just parameters to tweak, and those are not so hard to adjust as you go on.
When Nabity was crunching the bike numbers, the project didn't even have a name. Now it's called Freewheeling, and free bicycles are available during the convention week at 10 stations throughout Denver. Freewheeling's Tim Blumenthal says his organization has tried to learn from a Paris-based bike share.
And the problem that they had there was that nobody wanted to ride the bikes up the hill to this one famous church, but everybody wanted to ride the bikes back down.
There aren't many hills in Denver, but Matt Nabity and his fellow students have run countless computer models trying to ensure that all 1,000 bikes don't end up clumped at stations nearest the convention center. And as politicians, delegates, and friends of delegates peddle their way to the evening speeches, most of them won't even realize that they're riding on a foundation built by math. For NPR News, I'm Pendarvis Harshaw.
And this is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Melissa Block.
And I'm Robert Siegel. Vice presidents hold a special and odd place in American politics. 14 have gone on to the presidency. The majority lapse into obscurity once their terms are over. Alvin Barkley was Harry Truman's vice president from 1949 to 1953. Barkley never made it to the presidency. And to the extent that he is remembered, it's largely for two things: his nickname and the circumstances of his death. Producers Joe Richman and Samara Freemark of Radio Diaries bring us this audio portrait of the first vice president known as the Veep.
My name's Steve Truitt. I am the grandson of Alvin W. Barkley. My grandfather was born in a log cabin in Kentucky, and he loved to talk and tell stories, and he loved singing it. You could barely restrain him. It seems like he came from a different era.
Well, this is a song that I have remembered from my boyhood days, and it's come down with me for half a century. See that dummy coming down the line, my baby. See that dummy coming down the line this evening. See that dummy coming down the line. He had to run sideways to keep from flying, my baby.
My grandfather was very much in favor of assisting the poor and not particularly sympathetic to the wealthier classes. So his concept of government was of Uncle Sam, as he used to say, not some lazy guy sitting back on a cushion someplace, but rolling up his sleeves and actually getting things done.
In my 40 years of public life in Washington, I have advanced that theory over the opposition of a great many people who believe in just standing still, that Uncle Sam or the government ought to be hitched to a post, and notwithstanding improvements in every other field, like agriculture, medicine, education, transportation, that government and politics itself ought to stand still. I don't believe that. Catching rabbits ain't no sin. Open your mouth and shove 'em in this evening.
In 1948, the Democrats' convention is in Philadelphia, and Truman hadn't made up his mind who could select as vice president. And the convention was going to go with whoever Truman decided.
Senator Alvin Barkley of Kentucky delivered the keynote speech to the Democratic National Convention.
In the Declaration of Independence,
my grandfather gave an impassioned keynote address to rouse the Democrats off their bottoms and on their feet.
Thomas Jefferson did not proclaim that all white men, all black men, or red or yellow men are equal, that all rich or poor men are equal, that all good or bad men are equal. What he declared was that all men are equal.
And that was that. He was selected as Harry Truman's vice president.
Senator Barkley and I'll win this election and make these Republicans like it. Don't you forget that.
Harry Truman's blunt challenge in 1948 was the opening gun of a fighting campaign that exhilarated the electorate and dazed the experts.
When he was vice president, my grandfather lived 2.5 blocks from where we lived. So he was over at our house all the time. And one evening he was talking about his form of address, which he thought Mr. Vice President was too wordy and long-winded.
So everywhere I went, people were saying, what should we call you? Well, one night I was out at my daughter's, and she has 4 boys. And the youngest kid says to me, why, he said, Gramps, why not put two little E's in there between those 2 big letters and call it Veep?
He did so the next day to the press corps, and thus it entered the lexicon.
Ladies and gentlemen, I present to you the self-designated Veep, the Honorable Alvin W. Barkley, Vice President of the United States.
My grandfather wanted to be president a lot. It was the logical terminus of his entire life. So in 1952, my grandfather actively sought the nomination. But at that time, he was a lot older than anybody else who'd ever run for president, and he did not get the support of labor. United Auto Workers felt that he was too old, so he withdrew his name. He was bitterly disappointed, but he moved on. My grandfather returned to the Senate and sat on the back row for the remainder of his term there.
On April 30, 1956, Alvin Barkley, back in the Senate again at the age of 78, was making a speech at Washington and Lee University.
I have served my country and my people for half a century as a Democrat.
He was going through his standard speech and then digressed and talked about that people asked him, did he mind being in the back row, the place reserved for the most junior senators, having spent many, many years as the majority leader in the front row. And he had said, no, he did not mind that because, as he used to say, the race is not always to the quick.
I was a junior congressman, then I became a senior congressman, and then I went to the Senate,
and became a junior senator, and then I became a senior senator, and then majority leader of the Senate, and then vice president of the United States, and now I'm back again as a junior senator. And I am willing to be a junior. I am glad to sit on the back row, for I would rather be a servant in the house of the Lord than to sit in the seats of the mighty.
The next sound you hear is thump.
Senator Barkley just collapsed as he finished saying, "I had rather be a servant in the house of the Lord than in the seat of the mighty."
Good doctor, somebody call for a doctor.
And he died on the spot. And that's the way it turned out.
See that dummy coming down the line, my baby. See that dummy coming down the line this evening. See that dummy coming down the line. He had to run sideways to keep from flying, my baby.
The voice of Alvin Barkley, the Veep. Our story was produced by Joe Richman and Samara Freemark of Radio Diaries, with help from Deborah George.
Shove 'em in this evening. See these diamonds in my breast, my baby. See these diamonds in my breast this evening. See these diamonds in my breast. Tell all my women I'm gone to rest, my baby.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Organizing the Olympics was a massive logistical challenge. All those athletes, all those countries, all those languages. For commentator Frank DeFord, the show brought to mind a few basic truths about running sports events.
The Olympics reminded me again about the four guiding principles of sports organizations. Number one, it's much easier to run a team sport than an individual sport. Number two, it's much easier to run a domestic sport than an international sport. Number three, any sports organization that has the word federation in its title is probably a mess. And number four, any sports organization where volunteers have a lot of power over the professionals is really, really going to be screwed up. The subset to number four is beware of any sports organization where too many people in authority wear blue blazers. The classic best sports organization in all the world is the National Football League. See, it's not only a team sport, but it is completely domestic, all-American. It is so American that the NFL game is even called American football. I think it's the only sport in the world that's identified by a country. Nobody says Indonesian badminton or Scottish golf. Even better for the NFL, hardly anybody else anywhere in the world even plays American football. So there's no federation with lots of volunteers to get in the way of what the NFL wants to do. The commissioner of the NFL, whose name doesn't matter since Pete Rozelle left, has the cushiest job in sport. It's sort of like running General Motors before the Japanese made cars. The most difficult decisions the commissioner of the NFL must make are along the lines of, "Oh my, what in the world are we going to do about Brett Favre?" And, "How can I keep Jerry Jones happy?" And, "How long do I suspend players who shoot people in nightclubs?" By contrast, look at sports like boxing or tennis. They're all individuals in different countries, so nobody can ever take charge. Tennis is so confusing that it runs about 64 weeks a year. Tennis and boxing also have so many competing agencies that they're all just identified by their initials, so nobody even knows who anybody is. We have the ITF and the WBC and the WTA and the WBA and the ATP and the WBF. American professional football has the commissioner. Team sports in all countries are invariably placed under more scrutiny because fans are so loyal to their teams, and thus they force management to try and keep things on the up and up. But the more spread out a sports organization, the more diffuse its charge, and the more individuals rather than teams are competing, the more inefficiency, and also the more opportunity for chicanery. Do you really think the International Olympic Committee is capable of finding out how old those itty-bitty little Chinese gymnasts really are? Please. But whatever you think about America in the 21st century, the NFL probably works better than anything else in the United States, and maybe even better than Putin runs the Kremlin.
Commentator Frank DeFord joins us each Wednesday morning. The ruthless and powerful organization that brings him to us is member station WSHU in Fairfield, Connecticut.
Hey, it's Mickey.
It's Slate blogger Mickey Kouse with a late-night voicemail from the Democratic Convention.
You know how when you give a party and you have a great time and you get this warm glow when you think about it? And then you start remembering the people who didn't show up and you get a little annoyed? Well, Hillary's speech last night was sort of like that. It was effective, but then you began to realize the things she didn't say. She didn't say that Obama won fair and square. She didn't say things got a little rough in the course of a campaign, and I said some things in the heat of battle, but I came to respect Barack Obama for his sterling judgment or his epic legislative skills. She didn't say that. And specifically, she didn't say he's ready to lead as commander-in-chief. I guess those guests are off somewhere else by their own having a sort of little party, and Obama's not invited. See ya.
Mickey Kouse writes the Kouse Files blog for Slate.com.
And if you would like to blog about this, you can. Go to npr.org/daydreaming. There's a posting there that I wrote asking whether Hillary Clinton's speech last night was enough to convince her supporters to vote for Barack Obama. npr.org/daydreaming. And stay with us on Day to Day from NPR News.
Friday morning will mark 3 years since Hurricane Katrina arrived on the Gulf Coast. Here's what's changed since the floodwaters receded from New Orleans. The school system is being reinvented. The city has a new inspector general. The levees are getting new floodgates. And by most estimates, more than two-thirds of the residents have returned out of an original population of about 450,000. Here's what has not changed, according to some residents. One of America's great cities is irreversibly diminished. NPR's John Burnett roamed New Orleans in the days that its streets were flooded, and his words bring alive what it feels like to walk those streets today.
On one level, the sensuousness of New Orleans is all there. The smell of tea olive blossoms on a muggy summer night, the taste of praline bacon at Elizabeth's restaurant, the sound of a high school marching band warming up on Napoleon Avenue. Three years after the epic storm flooded 80% of New Orleans, some hard-hit neighborhoods are recovering better than many expected, and the people have shown great resilience.
How's the city doing now? Is the glass half full or half empty still?
Half full!
Donald Benjamin lives in a just-restored blue-and-white shotgun house with his chihuahua, Riva. He sits in his driveway under a crepe myrtle tree in his Gentilly neighborhood visiting with friends. While Benjamin thinks things are getting better, he takes the long view.
They're not going to come back in 3 years. I don't believe it'll be 5 years. I don't believe it'll be 10 years before this city is back together.
Most of the houses on this block, which took 6 feet of water, have been renovated and reoccupied, though a few still sit moldering in the tropical sun. Resident Simone Lewis, who lives on the corner, says moving away was never an option.
This is our home. This is what we know. We know no other way but New Orleans. We love New Orleans. We have our heart, our walk, our talk, everything is in New Orleans.
I walk across the street to the home of Greta and Winston Burns. She's a retired clerk for a judge. He's a retired high school coach.
We're back, and we're happy to be home, but it's not the same. It is not the same. So much is so different. Of course, we've only been back 2 months, like I said.
But in those 2 months, she's noticed that the Parents Club that used to raise money for St. Augustine High School, where her four boys went, has dissolved. The regional track meet Winston used to organize was canceled. The Chapman-Trump Social Club, where Greta and her friends would cook a pot of jambalaya, play cards, and talk about their children.
Oh, that's over. Oh, that's over. We don't even meet anymore because some of the members are no longer in New Orleans.
And why haven't they come back? For one thing, the housing picture remains grim. Residents report rents doubling and tripling. Smokey Johnson, who played drums for Fats Domino for 28 years, was one of the lucky ones. He's paying off a green shotgun built in Musicians Village by Habitat for Humanity.
There's a lot of friends of mine can't get back. There's a lot of them that are musicians. They can't pay the rent.
A recent Brookings study reports that New Orleans' population grew 19% from 2006 to 2007, but only 3% from 2007 to 2008. The population is slightly older, slightly higher income, and slightly whiter, though the city is still majority African American. Tulane University biographer Richard Campanella says the flattening curve of the rate of return has a message.
This, to me, I would read as a stabilization and the emergence of the post-Katrina New Orleans we all wondered about 3 years ago, what it would look like.
In other words, New Orleanians will continue to return, but the repopulation curve suggests it will be a trickle rather than a wave. What that could mean for the mostly black districts devastated by the storm, such as Gentilly, the Lower Ninth Ward, and New Orleans East, is deeply troubling to Lynette Causey, an African-American clinical psychologist. She sits behind her handsome, recently rebuilt home in New Orleans East, which today has almost no doctors.
We had a great network of African-American professionals, and many of them were in private practice, and many of them had to go elsewhere to make a living, and so they're not back.
Yet Dr. Causey doesn't want to sound like she's complaining, because she knows the nation is tired of hearing it.
You know, the 15 minutes is gone, it's done with, it's over. So what happens is you stop talking about it for the most part, you know, and you just live.
Even for those who were minimally affected by Katrina, just deciding to stay has become something of a defiant declaration, especially if they're in a profession where they can get a good job elsewhere, like Dr. Sissy Sarter, a fertility specialist.
Now you're throwing your lot with a city that... There are many wonderful things that have happened since the storm, but it's still not clear if this is going to be a phoenix rising out of the ashes or sort of perhaps a slow slide backwards.
And yet there is hope all over the city. Every person interviewed for this story, most of whom lost everything, said the glass is half full. Author Tom Piazza feared the worst in his 2005 book, Why New Orleans Matters. The city's spirit is in terrible jeopardy right now, he writes. If it dies, something precious and profound will go out of the world forever. Now that fear has passed.
I realized this spring that New Orleans was starting to recover a certain bounce in its step. It was starting to feel more like New Orleans to me. For the first couple of years after the storm, there was a kind of... palpable and present sense of loss. Some of that is burning off.
But what of the roughly 130,000 people who've not come back? The largest group, some 100,000, have started new lives in Houston, for better or for worse.
You can't get a po' boy here like you wanna. They say it's a po' boy, but it's not.
Tyra Weatherspoon, a 38-year-old bank employee, fled uptown New Orleans with its streetcars and ancient oaks and gumbo houses for the featureless Houston suburb of Cypress. And her life has improved in nearly every way. In the last 3 years, she's married, she's bought a spacious 4-bedroom home for a fraction of what she would have paid in New Orleans. Po' boys aside, she says she's close to good hospitals and good schools for her 3 children. Will she ever move home to New Orleans?
Maybe in a few years, maybe after they've done some more revamping, and also the levees. They're not fixed to where you can have another Katrina. That's horrifying. So until that is fixed, I don't think I'll go back no time soon.
There's no place like home unless you find a better place to call home. John Burnett, NPR News.
Later this week on Morning Edition, we'll meet an amateur filmmaker
whose video captured New Orleans' destruction and who has returned to the city.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Melissa Block.
And I'm Robert Siegel. The success of the Xbox has largely been built on video games such as Gears of War, Halo, Combat Evolved, and its successors. A couple of weeks ago, though, Xbox launched a more philosophical game, and it instantly became a hit on Xbox Live, the company's download service. It's called Braid, and it's more a meditation on the meaning of life than a shoot-'em-up. Within 6 days, the game was downloaded more than 50,000 times. As Heather Chaplin reports, video game critics are calling Braid a masterpiece.
Braid is not your usual video game.
It's a meaning-of-life kind of game.
That's Jonathan Blow, the game's designer.
The idea was, hey, wouldn't it be cool if you had this game where you could travel from world to world, and each world was an exploration or a meditation about different ideas about our reality?
Play as Tim, a tiny figure scuttling his way across the screen through a series of mind-bending puzzles. You have to figure out when to move forward in time and when to move backward. As you play, you realize that Tim has a lonely past and is alienated from his lady love, and that all the moving backward and forward in time is actually a metaphor for Tim's attempts to figure out what went wrong in his relationship and where exactly he fits into the universe. When you rewind time, the screen turns red and the music plays backwards. It's disconcerting and disorienting. Just like plumbing your own past can be unsettling.
Everything about our daily lives is predicated on this very solid difference between past and future, right? The past has happened, the future hasn't happened, therefore I have choices about what I can make happen. Therefore my life has meaning somehow. If you start questioning that kind of thing, if you fundamentally start calling into question some of the things that obviously should be questioned, it very rapidly pulls you out of that stream of everybody going in a certain direction, and it's very uncomfortable. It's very isolating.
Braid feels like a game that a grown-up can play, that a grown-up perhaps ought to play. Braid pulsates with feelings of loss, loneliness, and longing, which means Jonathan Blow is violating one of the cardinal rules of game-making, that games have to be fun. Fun with a capital F and an exclamation point.
You know, the game doesn't give you a bigger sword that does more damage to enemies or anything like that. It doesn't put on any light shows and fireworks and say, you're awesome for solving this puzzle. You simply feel the satisfaction of having done something that seemed difficult at first and having expanded your understanding.
It doesn't feel immature the way other games feel because it doesn't short you in any respect.
That's Sam Roberts, games director for the Slam Dance Film Festival's Guerrilla Game Making Competition and an early champion of Braid.
It expects as much from you as an audience member as any other fully adult media and media for adults does.
Robert says he was struck by how rich and fulfilling Braid felt. Robert also says that unlike most game makers who test market their games incessantly, Blow wasn't trying to satisfy any particular audience. Rather, he felt driven to make the game, if for no other reason than to please himself. Jonathan Blow agrees.
Whoever satisfactorily answers the question of why people create art, I don't have a satisfactory answer to that question either, but it's just, it's the same thing, I think, as anybody who's compelled to make something in their medium, like compelled to, not really wants to, or feels like it would be a good idea.
Despite everything you hear about the magic of video games, making players feel richer and more fulfilled isn't generally at the top of the list. Maybe it's time they were. For NPR News, I'm Heather Chaplin.